Hello and welcome to the next instalment of the Global Investigations podcast, a series that tackles the reputational, legal and commercial issues facing business when looking to manage investigations risk. I'm Louis Shippen, a member of our client solutions team, and I'm joined today in London by Matthew Bruce, a partner in our corporate crime team.
Hello, Louis.
Holly Inslee, a senior associate in our people and rewards team.
Hello.
And in Washington by Bruce McCulloch, a partner in our antitrust, competition and trade group.
Hello.
In this episode, we'll be discussing the evolving approaches businesses are taking to manage conduct risk and some of the challenges that are arising. Matthew, if we start with you, what are some of the themes that we're seeing?
Thanks, Louis. Well, first of all, let's just go back to what conduct risk means. And within the ranks of any large organisation, there'll at some point be bad actors, people who intentionally do the wrong thing, often for personal gain. And companies clearly need controls in place to help prevent those rogue employees or agents from causing harm. That's the obvious manifestation of conduct risk. But you also need to think about the people who simply veer off course, who make poor decisions or go along with the poor decisions of others, who are somehow able to justify a course of action to themselves that can end up putting the company at real risk. Everything from data breaches to violations of antitrust law or bribery. And given the extent of the issues that can arise from employee or agent behaviour, it makes sense to approach them, at least in part, through the lens of conduct. Because if you get those underlying behaviours right, then you can hopefully avoid, or at least significantly reduce, your legal risk in a range of areas. And Lou, I've spoken to quite a few companies recently about adopting this holistic approach, and there are several themes that come up again and again. Firstly, underpinning all of it is the move many companies are making towards a more principles-based approach to compliance, giving people the framework for how they're expected to act. There's also, of course, the ongoing challenge of really demonstrating tone from the top. For example, not just having management tell people what kind of conduct they expect, but actually showing them that they really mean it. And another big theme is how companies surface and investigate issues, especially when it's not always clear what the misconduct is or the consequence of it. We've spoken about this on earlier podcasts, about the importance of ensuring you recognise the nature of the risk early enough. So there's many aspects to conduct risk.
So we won't be able to get through all of those themes today, but I'd like to start by asking Bruce about the principles-based approach and focus on behaviours rather than rules. What does it look like in practice?
Yeah, thanks, Louis. Most of all, companies want compliance to be effective. And some recognize that old school methods, for example, thick compliance manuals, strict do's and don'ts, are not always effective. A heavy rules-based approach focuses on a lot of detail and process, and it risks not seeing the forest for the trees. It also can be dry and boring, and you want people to be engaged. Rules-based compliance can't cover all scenarios, and it often leads to black and white dictates when there often is a large gray area. On the other hand, principles-based compliance provides an overarching framework that covers more circumstances and helps protect against unknown or blind risks. This kind of approach is often more in line with broad company values and can be communicated more easily across large companies. Ultimately, you want to win the hearts and minds battle, that which is key to preventing misconduct in the long term. But don't get me wrong, there's still a place for rules, but we are talking about a shift in focus in messaging and how the company deploys its compliance resources.
Might some see board members, for example, see this as a bit fluffy, particularly if the authorities come knocking?
Maybe, or yes, if we are only talking about high-level platitudes rather than practices that lead to a culture of compliance. And we are obviously talking about the latter here. In the U.S., the Department of Justice has released guidance on antitrust compliance specifically, but the principles cut across all compliance risk areas. The DOJ made it very clear that off-the-shelf compliance programs are not sufficient. And off-the-shelf, I'm talking about the compliance manual and once-a-year training may not be sufficient. And DOJ guidelines state that there must be a genuine focus on risk assessment for each company, and the program must work in practice. Is it effective? Does it produce results? In a principle-based approach, it can still have structure and be measurable. You can track the awareness of compliance hotlines. You can compile evidence of how compliance issues are dealt with and how quickly they're dealt with. You can track training. None of this goes away in a principle-based approach. It's not revolutionary. It's just a shift. And lastly, as Matthew mentioned earlier, these principles must be delivered and reinforced by management. And that's management all the way to the top. And it is much easier and more relatable for management to extol broad principles as opposed to bright line rules.
Bruce is just jumping in there. Bruce has talked there about and mentioned the DOJ guidelines and the emphasis on making sure that programs work in practice and that companies can demonstrate that. And we've seen the Serious Fraud Office take a similar approach in its sixth DPA, which is the Gurelp Systems Limited, which was announced in December of 2019. And in that, the company agreed to report to the SFO on its remediation efforts and compliance program annually throughout the course of the DPA. And that's not unusual. But what was interesting about it, it's agreed to share the actual results of its due diligence on third-party intermediaries rather than simply providing details of its processes or metrics on completion rates. And it also has to report each year on the effectiveness of its training and the level of awareness among employees of its anti-bribery program. So we're seeing that focus on effectiveness and demonstrating that things are working in practice, not just on paper, which is very close to the approach the DOJ is adopting, as Bruce mentioned.
There's probably a good point to bring in Holly to talk about training, which seems to underpin so many of businesses' efforts in these areas. How do you make it effective and avoid training fatigue?
I think it's a really difficult question. It's something that most companies are grappling with because, as Matthew's just explained, effectiveness is so critical and testing effectiveness is then even more critical. On top of that, obviously, as a starting point, you need your employees to actually be attending training. You don't even get out of the starting blocks if they're not. But then beyond that, how are you making sure it's hitting home and how are you demonstrating that you've done that? Starting point, try and make it real. And that has a few aspects to it. So one is tailoring it to the individual's role and the area of the business that they're within. Because if you give antitrust training, for example, where none of the real life examples you're giving actually bear any resemblance to what the individual will come across in their day job, then it's not going to be as effective as if you've tailored it to what they do. And the other aspect of making it real is recognizing that when things do come across people's desks, they're not neatly labeled. If you go to anti-bribery training, then you know that the sorts of examples that you're going to be presented with are likely to raise anti-bribery issues. Nothing is that neatly labeled when you actually come across it in real life. And so I think one of the ways of making training a bit more effective is not necessarily telling employees in advance what sort of training it is, or possibly mixing up a few different things, because we know from practice that actually there can be risks within risks. There could be a potential antitrust issue buried within what presents as an ABC issue, or vice versa. And if you mix your training up like that and you make people work to actually spot the risk areas that they're dealing with, then it can make the training more effective. Relevance comes in again when you're thinking about exactly what the training should cover, and you need to think about your aims. But depending on the role that somebody is performing, there's a question as to whether they need to know all the kind of legal intricacies, the legal tests for bribery, for example, or whether, going back to the points we've covered already, it's more important that they understand the sorts of behaviours that they need to be looking out for, either in their own kind of conduct or in the conduct of their colleagues. And then the final point, and probably the most important point after all of that, is the follow-up and the testing. So how do you know that the message has hit home? And that might be something simple like multiple choice quiz at the end of training. That's what people usually do. I think a lot of companies are starting to figure out how they go beyond that. So actually, could it be something a bit more creative, like a fake phishing email a few weeks after some cybersecurity training, something like that? And if somebody takes the bait and clicks on that email when they should know not to, then putting them back through a sort of second level of training. And that's all really important in terms of actually being able to show not only that you've got the attendance at training, which, as I said, is how you get out the starting blocks, but actually that your training has been effective and that you've really thought carefully about effectiveness and whether you're delivering it in the best possible way.
We're almost running out of time and we won't get a chance to go through all of the many themes that Matthew mentioned at the beginning. But we didn't want to finish without addressing one key issue that comes up time and time again, and that is dealing with resource constraints. Very large companies often have very small legal and compliance teams. How can they effectively address conduct risk across their business when dealing with this resource constraint? A couple of quick thoughts from each of you. So, Bruce, if we start with you.
That is an important issue. And in an investigation, the DOJ and other regulators will ask, is the compliance function properly resourced? If a compliance team believes that it is critically under-resourced or underfunded, then it obviously should raise that internally. That said, there's no formula to gauge the proper level of resource or the number of compliance team members. And even companies with relatively well-resourced compliance functions run into difficulties. So the more helpful question is how do you make the most of whatever resources you have? Take a look at the compliance program today, assess what it is doing, and identify areas of weakness and determine the cause of the weakness. Is it resources or is it something else? If resources are an issue, one way to remedy that is to leverage other functions. For example, internal audit and human resources can help spot issue, deliver the message, or assist in training.
And I would add a point to that around messaging. You would use functions like internal audit and probably more HR to help reinforce your messaging. But actually, the wider business has a really important role to play in that and making sure that any message that starts at the top works its way down. And we talk quite a lot about tone from the top and its importance. But I think one of the things that it pays to remember is that actually the top can mean different things for different people. So for some people, the top will be the board, and it's very important what message is coming out of the boardroom. But actually for others, the top will be regional or divisional CEOs, for example. It might even be somebody's immediate line manager. And so making sure that whatever message has started in the boardroom has filtered all the way down and got to whatever is somebody else's top is really important. The other point I would make is around speak up culture, because you won't always persuade everybody to behave in the right way. You won't always stop people from inadvertently straying off track. And what then becomes very important is that if that does happen, you catch it as soon as you possibly can.
For me, I mean, Bruce and Holly have made fantastic points. I mean, if I were to make a couple of comments, first, know your business, even when resources are stretched. That is time that is very valuably spent. It helps you with your risk assessment. It helps you identify those risk signalers that might mean a certain part of the business warrants closer attention. You need to know where best to deploy your limited resources, and business engagement is really the first step to doing that. The second point is don't waste a crisis. Always take what you've learned from any crisis and use it to improve your program. And you don't have to, in fact, wait really for a crisis to hit. You can also learn that information from lower level incidents or near misses. Time spent on those lessons learned and root cause exercises is, in my view, often very well spent. It can ensure the compliance program evolves and stays fit for purpose. Often it's something quite discreet that comes out of a lesson learned, like an additional piece of training or a communication or a tweak to a process. But the cumulative effect of all of that adds up. And over time, that approach can help turn the dial on conduct and behaviours within an organisation.
That's all for today. Thanks very much for joining. Matthew, Holly and Bruce, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks and bye-bye.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for listening. If you like this podcast, I would encourage you to go to freshwaters.com and have a listen to others in the Global Investigations series, in particular episode 1, which looks at responding to suspect activity, and episode 2, Why Things Go Wrong, which looks at the red flags in culture and governance, which, if left unchecked, can give rise to these issues. We've also recently launched a sanctions and export control series, which is well worth a listen.